Welcome to the 78th edition of the Gooner podcast, recorded immediately after number 77 on the Wednesday evening before Arsenal begin their Premier League season at St James's Park. Our previous competitive match was the 2-2 draw at Fulham back in May. How time flies. Thanks as ever to our sponsors, GoonerShirts.com, the website for all your quality cult Arsenal t-shirt needs. I'm your host, David Udo, and still with us are our panel of Mark Ollington, Joe Broadfoot, and Kevin Witcher. Now, guys, although it's Newcastle away on Saturday, essentially the following Wednesday and then the Tuesday immediately after that, it's going to be really big because not only are we looking to qualify for the Champions League, maybe best part of 6 months beforehand, we've got a very, very tricky tie with Udinese. Mark, how hard would it be to qualify for the 2011-2012 Champions League?
It shouldn't be difficult, should it? The Italian league is not what it was. I think, like us, Udinese come forth in their respective leagues. They have signed a couple of quality players, which also could be us by the time we get to the game. But having said that, the Italian league isn't what it was, and you would expect over two legs to kind of go through. But having said that, it's not an easy draw. It's not difficult as some are making out, but we have got players suspended. I think Van Persie can't play in the game. So, you know, it is good. And then we have got injuries once again at the start of the season. So who knows what the starting 11 will actually be. So we will see the squad players like Chamakh probably play. And perhaps even the Scalacci's of the world. It's not going to be... If I was a betting man, which I'm not because I'm a tight ass, but I would put money on us to actually go through. But it's not a given, is it? 70%er, I'd say.
Fair enough. Joe, your thoughts? Are we easily going to beat what was apparently the fourth best team in Italy, who have since sold three of their best players?
It's never going to be easy against Italian opposition because they're going to park the bus at the Emirates, and so it's going to be difficult to score.
If Spurs can beat an Italian team, I think we can.
Yeah, but an understrength Arsenal, when the squad is weaker, in my opinion, weaker than last season in terms of personnel, not necessarily in terms of age, because all our youngsters are now 1 year older, therefore more experienced. So we should be a better side in theory, but it's the beginning of the season, and for once the fans are not optimistic. I mean, it's not just around this table, all the fans that I've bumped into, none of them are really looking forward to this season, unfortunately. I wish I could say differently, but that's the situation at the club. So if anything goes wrong, say Udinese score the first goal, let's hope it doesn't happen. If they score the first goal and then actually nick another goal, what's going to happen? What are the crowd going to be saying to the players, the young players? If they were experienced, they can probably handle it. But we haven't got that much experience, and we're going to be under strength on the first game. So as long as we score the first goal, I think we'll be fine. But if we don't, I think it could be a problem. And I really hope that doesn't happen, obviously.
Kev, bearing in mind we're at home for the first leg, Udinese have got literally just one star player, being Alessandro Di Natale, their centre-forward. Bearing in mind we're going to be without Van Persie, we're going to be without Nasri, and there's going to be no manager on the bench. Who are we going to play in our forward attacking positions? That's kind of like one up front in his own, and then three behind, being two on the width.
Well, you'd imagine that on the assumption that Bentner is on his way out, Chamakh is the only conceivable centre-forward. Wide, you'd have to imagine Walcott's not going to be fit, and he's not going to play Fabregas.
Resistini?
It could be Resistini. Yeah. You can't rule it out. There's a possibility he might play Ramsey there instead. So Ramsey or Rizicki in the hole. Left side, probably Arshavin, mm-hmm. and right side, Jovino. So whether or not that particular combination can create the goals we need remains to be seen. The one thing about the tie is that I do believe the players will be as motivated as it's possible for them to be, because, you know, they don't want to be in the Europa League. So, you know, fat salaries or not, I'm hoping to see a bit of effort and a bit of commitment and a bit of drive and determination, especially in the first leg, to hopefully secure the tie, so that there's no potential for a slip-up back in Italy. What I wouldn't like is if things were a bit tight going over to Italy, because, you know, once you go away from home, you can get all kinds of things going against you. And the referee, for example, if we get a homer over there, then we could be in trouble with dodgy penalties or that kind of thing. So it's very important that we do tie up the first leg. For your benefit, David, if you do turn up on Wednesday, you won't be seeing any football because the first leg's on a Tuesday night. but, I mean, let's just hope that whether or not you're there, the team turn up.
Well, that's fair enough. I mean, I suppose the only other question is whether Nasri is going to play in the second leg, if indeed he is still at the club. And whether Fabregas is available for both legs. He's our club captain. He can play if we want to. But ultimately, he does want to leave. Mark, do you think, well, A, Fabregas is going to play, and B, whether Nasri is going to play in the second leg?
No, I think both players will certainly not be played. I think Nasri will be gone by the end of this week. I could be wrong by the time this podcast goes out, but I firmly believe he'll be at Man City by the weekend. And I don't think he'll risk Fabregas for serious injury. So, no, I can't see it happening. I could be totally wrong. I'm wrong about many things in life, sadly, Dave. As my wife will tell you all, if she had the chance on this podcast. Lucky she's not here tonight, and I'll be here with you lovely lads instead. But to answer the question, no, I don't think so.
Okay, in a word, yourself,
Mr. Joe.
A word about the result of that game?
Well, whether you think there's any chance of Nasri or Fabregas playing?
Nasri, no, and Fabregas, no. I don't see either of those two players appearing.
In which case, Kevin, there's only one question I'm going to put to you, which is, have we got any chance of getting past Udinese and qualifying for the Champions League this season?
On the basis that they also are a weaker team than at the end of last season, we do have every chance. I mean, the one thing which does actually suit Arsenal is playing European football against lesser teams. You know, that's the one thing we normally manage to do just about well enough. It's only when we come against really big teams that we're exposed. So if we were exposed by Udinese, then things are going to turn very ugly, and I don't think that's going to happen.
Okay, fair enough. The other question I've got is sort of looking at the latter horse rather than this one, which is, how hard will it be to qualify for the 2012-2013 Champions League? So let's sod this year, because, you know, at this stage, who knows what's going to happen next week and the week after. Let's hope that we're going to be absolutely fine and Arsenal's nose will be the comment everyone comes out with. Let's hope we get through that. Bearing in mind Chelsea have a new manager, that Manchester United won the league and then immediately went out and bought three new players purely for their starting 11. And Manchester City haven't bought three players. Mark,
yes.
How hard do you think it will be for us to finish in the top, well, ideally the top three by the end of the season, failing that, the top four?
Top three is not going to happen. Top three, pretty much guaranteed, Man City, United, Chelsea. It's going to be a three-horse race, I think, for fourth place, us, Liverpool, and then Tottenham. And I think, you know, it's going to be really, really, really tough. I don't kind of buy this fact that Liverpool are going to be a really great team all of a sudden because King Kenny's back and everything else. I think I'll take that with a huge pinch of salt. And as it stands at the moment, Spurs have hardly been active in the transfer market, less than us. But you know that old bloody, that crook will be there to the last minute for him to try to do some deals. And it wouldn't surprise me if he beat up to players like Samba. That wouldn't surprise me at all. So it is going to be really difficult, actually, to come fourth place. And it's not going to be bang, bang, bang on this season at all. And a lot will depend upon how the start of the season goes. Traditionally, we have a good start. So it's only when October and November comes about, we have a little kind of mid-season blip. And the sad thing is, we have got a tough August. And we're talking, the reason why I think a lot of fans have got fed up with the fact we haven't made our signings yet is, if it does happen on August the 31st, that's potentially three really difficult league matches, and that's a total of nine points. And if we come away with 2 points from the first three games, we're going to be playing catch-up for the rest of the season. Leagues aren't won in August, of course, and that's true, but 1/9 of the league is won in August, and you know that's a vital part of it. And I just think we might be leaving it a bit too late, and it's not going to be as easy as, you know, as it has been in previous seasons.
Just shaking head from you, Joe.
I'm agreeing. I must be. I'm not sure why I'm shaking my head, but I've never agreed so much with Mark.
What's happening today, Joe?
Because I've gone into this alternate universe. But anyway, the head shake, man. I can't believe how much sense Mark is talking.
Jesus Christ!
It was that much sense because August is such a crucial month for Arsene Wenger and Arsenal Football Club because we really need those points on the board more than ever. Because as Mark rightly said, those games coming up are so tough. And yet, I thought, based on the fixture list we got, I thought, Arsene Wenger's definitely going to buy some players now, some players that are going to make a difference. Jovinho, I think, is going to be a very good signing, but we didn't really need him. And the others, well, they're squad players, let's be honest, for this season at least. So where is the squad strengthening? I want to see it. I've not seen it as of yet. And yet we've got this tough fixture list. It couldn't be much tougher, could it? No. Newcastle and Liverpool, Manchester United.
That Liverpool game would be key, really. And also, Kev, you made a comment yet. But don't you think Arsenal Liverpool will be, even at really early doors and the teams haven't settled in yet and stuff, that's a massive game, isn't it, at the start of the season?
Yes, I mean it is, because it's the first home game. And you want the crowd to get behind the team, and the relationship isn't great at the moment between the crowd and the team. So if that game didn't go well, especially given what happened the last time Liverpool came, we could be in for a season of pantomime booing, frankly, which isn't going to help anybody. I think you're underestimating Liverpool. I think since Dalglish did arrive, their form probably would have won them the Premier League if it had been over the course of the entire season. I think the one thing Dalglish can do is motivate, and he can organise. And he's bought players significantly. He's bought British players who are going to gel quickly. You know, he's not buying the Benitez-type buys from abroad. They're players who are established in the Premier League. You know, we might not rate Stuart Downing, but, you know, he's the kind of player I would say is akin to Ray Houghton, who was bloody brilliant in 87-88, even though he's not a flair player. But because he was in the blend, he looked bloody good. So, as a unit, I think Liverpool will be strong. I do believe that they will be better than Arsenal in the league, and that we are fighting for, effectively, I think we will finish fifth. I don't think Tottenham will compete, frankly. The other thing to remember about Liverpool is they're no European football of any description.
That's true. Right.
Which is an advantage.
It's a massive advantage, you put it that way. I didn't even think about that. Not even in the Europa League, are they?
Exactly. So, I think it is going to be a huge battle. If Arsene Wenger does buy two quality centre-backs, we're back in the mix. We could even challenge for the top three, but if he doesn't buy two centre backs, frankly, we are looking at fifth place.
Kevin, in fairness, the if you bring up with regards to Arsenal is sort of buying two extra players, which I personally completely agree with. You compare that with Liverpool, where Kenny Dalglish reports directly into John Henry, the person who controls all their money, and he says, "I want this player, go and fetch him." One of the thoughts would be interesting to get from you, I'll go to you if that's okay, Mark, with regard to Ivan Gazidis, who's had two performances to give in front of Arsenal players, supporters this summer. One of them being at the start, essentially, Arsene knows, don't worry, we've got it done. Now he's done the most recent, being a couple of days ago, and we aren't looking like signing a centre-half. How do you feel about Ivan Gazidis, and I suppose from a certain point of view, Arsene Wenger?
Well, I know Kev was there, so perhaps you can chip in, Kev, because you actually at the meeting itself, but from someone that's not involved in the supporters groups like you are, you're just going to read the kind of tweets and the kind of reports afterwards. The guy seems perfectly adept at he'd be a great spin doctor, he'd be great for the Tories at the moment, especially with all the riots that have taken place, a bit of politics for you there. But when it comes to actual hard work and effort and all graft, actually signing players, well, I think the guy's been sorely lacking. He's a great master of spin. He's perfectly adept at the kind of marketing and commercial aspects of the role with regards to how he presents himself to the media and to the fans. But sadly, lacking any substance from what I can make out. I mean, Kev, you're all there at these meetings. I mean, is that the kind of thing that you kind of get from him? I mean, are you impressed by him?
I think actions speak louder than words. I mean, the thing is, at the meetings, you do get lots of words. I mean, Gazidis is making out that transfers are very complicated and complex. His other argument is that Manchester United do not always get their transfer business concluded so early in the season. I mean, without actually researching it, I'd argue that's probably not actually true. I think they are very good at securing deals they want to do. So ultimately, what we don't know is the dynamic behind the scenes about who's doing what in the negotiations. You know, if you read someone like Miles Palmer, you might believe that Wenger is in total control and the board are frustrated as hell with him. I mean, one of the things I've heard is that Wenger was asked for a list of targets in May by the board, and he didn't give them one. So they had nothing to work with. Could be complete bullshit. I don't know. But there's that sort of story which makes you think, well, what is going on? You know, who is actually, you know, pressing the button on the transfers and making the final decisions? Now, my suspicion is that ultimately it is Arsene Wenger who's deciding that he doesn't want to pay 20 million for Phil Jagielka, and he's not prepared to offer 18 million. He's going to offer 14 million, and that's as far as I'm going. Well, I would prefer a system whereby he names what he needs and then he leaves someone to get on with it, because I think there's too much penny pinching, and I suspect it is to do with the manager's obsession with value. And as I've said in a previous podcast, when you're a big club, you've got to pay more than someone is worth to secure the player and swallow it. And you're making so much money. I mean, you know, they're piddling about over £2 or 3 million. If they don't make the Champions League, they're going to lose £25 million. Better to secure your chances of progress into that competition and that secured money than worry about £2 or 3 million. You know, the penny pinching is just too extreme at Arsenal. And, you know, we are more obsessed with the balance sheet than the trophy cabinet. And as a consequence, we've had summer after summer of dashed hopes. I mean, God, if we'd signed Xabi Alonso in 2008, you know, Liverpool that season subsequently lost two games with Alonso in midfield. Now, imagine what we could have done in that 2008-2009 season with him instead of bloody Dean Olsen playing there. God, it just sometimes... Basically, Gazidis, he plays a straight bat. He can deflect criticism with words, but his actions, sadly, have exposed that if Wenger's running the show, he's not being directed properly. You know, technically, he's an employee. Gazidis is his boss. So ultimately, Gazidis is to blame for letting that situation occur. And if it's not the case, if Gazidis is genuinely in charge, he's not producing the goods.
I think Kev's going to explode, Dave. He's so angry. Look at that.
I just going to turn to Joe, actually, and say, can you see any chance of the manager's job being under threat if the team do not start well, based on his behaviour, well, suggested by Ivan and essentially accused by Kevin?
I think Arsene Wenger's job certainly is under threat, and he's essentially doing two jobs, because he's also dealing on the transfer front. Back in the day, it was David Dean seemed to be concluding the transfers quite successfully, it seemed. And I don't know if I'm a supporter or one of his detractors. So I think I'm probably one of his supporters, actually, of David Dean, because it seemed to me, you know, on the surface, he was doing a good job, because there he was picking up players, bringing big names to the club, and getting these deals done early. This is the timing is so important. And now we're in August, and we've got games they're going to be coming thick and fast. And how does a team gel? Even if we do manage to make those purchases on the 31st of August, the season might be already semi down the pan at that point. So if we manage to bring in all the players and we just get like £500,000 off of this guy and, you know, £250,000 off of this guy, and we bring in all the players that Arsene Wenger wants or doesn't want, and where will that leave us? It's going to be a shambles. It's no way to conduct business. I just can't understand what's going on right now. I really thought Arsene Wenger... I'm by no means am I one of those people that want Arsene Wenger to leave, but I just want him to get the correct support, or perhaps he needs somebody strong who will go out there and say, you know, Arsene, you really need this guy. Just put him in your squad somewhere, because he's going to be useful to you. You need a centre-back. I know you don't realise it, Arsene, but you need a centre-back. You need somebody above 5'11" who can actually head a ball. You know, you need somebody... You might even need an English guy in there. You know that? You might actually need somebody. And you need someone that's going to play that role. And David Dean seemingly played that role. And now we don't have that. So all it seems to be... For me, look, from the outside looking in, seems like a bunch of yes men, and Arsene Wenger runs the ship. And Arsene Wenger's a good manager, but unfortunately, he's not a guy who can do two jobs. He can't be a manager, and he can't also be the guy that brings in all the players. It's just too much to ask of one person. So I have a little bit of sympathy for him, in the one sense, but
he's created that, and he will refuse to accept change. That's part of the problem.
I mean, you say football's also caught up with him, perhaps. I mean, I read quite a few articles this season that, you know, when he first came to Arsenal, the reason why we had the success that we did was he brought a lot of new methods into the country, such as diet and training and everything else, and sports science. But now everyone does that. So his USP is now gone. And essentially what he's doing now is he hasn't got that British base that he had when he first came to the club. And so essentially, it's just the team that Wenger built has become obsessed with this kind of creating this ultimate, masterful, great football playing team of midgets. And the rest of football caught with him in many other ways. And so really, he's kind of like floundering.
Do you know who the domestic English manager is who has the biggest backroom team to basically impress all of the Arsene Wenger impressions on his current team?
Tell me that, David Udo.
Sam Allardyce.
I was going to say that, funnily enough.
Yeah.
If you'd have asked me, I would have guessed Sam Allardyce.
So there
because,
we go.
Because he's very much into sports science. I mean, I know Arsene Wenger is as well, to a point. But every time I watch an Arsenal warm-up, I have to have a little laugh to myself. Because the other day, I took the time to go to Stevenage to watch the reserves playing. And it was quite amusing. No, I was there. And it was quite amusing watching the warm-ups. And if I hadn't known who was the bigger team, I would have said Stevenage, based on the way they warmed up and the sort of professionalism about how they went about what they did. Stevenage had a better warm-up. You know, from a coach's point of view, they had a better warm-up. Simple as that. Now, what does that say? I leave it open to
the Well, it says that the training and preparation of the Arsenal players is... frankly lacking in something substantial, and what you saw at Stevenage was symptomatic of a general problem in that what happens in training sessions is a lot of tip-tap but very little in the way of tactics or organisation or planning, and also physical practice. I mean, in terms of defending set pieces, you know, do we have drills? You know, is defence actually practised and coached? It doesn't appear so. You know, there is an idea which is basically the Wenger leaves the players to work it out for themselves. Well, that's okay if they're 28 and 29 and they've been coached properly when they were younger. Mm. Well, you're bringing in Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain. The guy doesn't know now. He needs guidance. Where's he going to get it from? He ain't going to get it from Arsene Wenger. You know, he's going to be left to work it out himself. I think it was Armand Traore who was at one of these charity dinners where the players join the table for coffee and dessert, and he was saying to someone who I think repeated it on one of the other podcasts, there are other podcasts available, and basically said, no one tells me, when you've done something wrong, no one tells you. You know, no one at Arsenal actually comes and says, this is what you do, you don't do this, you don't get the coaching, you don't get the guidance. So there's this sort of Zen-like Buddhist philosophy to coaching, this approach by Wenger, which ends up with some of the performances we witnessed last season, where the players as a team are obviously lacking in leadership, they need guidance, they look like a rudderless ship, and it all falls to pieces. And there's no sign that is going to change in the near future.
The only thing I'll sort of go forward to is purely because it's written in front of me, is we're heading towards the opening day of the season, that kind of thing. Woo-ha. Maybe it could be losing to Coventry at home. Maybe it could be getting hammered away to Manchester United. Who knows? Mark, what are your memories of any previous opening days we've got as Arsenal fans?
I have two, you know. One, the first only ever Arsenal goal that I've ever actually missed, and that was, I think it was 1-0 at home to QPR on, was it the 90 season after we won the Championship, the 91-92 season, and QPR went 1-0 up, and I was so upset and disgusted. I felt quite ill. I had a stomachache for the last few days. I thought, you know what, I'm going to leave early. And the minute I got out of the stadium, the North Bank cheered, and Magic Man Paul Merson equalised, and I vowed never to leave a game early ever again. And you know what, I probably have once or twice, but as a rule, I don't, and I stay to the very end. So right. That opening day of the season is very firm in my mind. The 14-year-old Mark made a big error that day, but left before the end of the match. I don't often do that now.
Make sure you have a curry on Friday night before the Newcastle game. Anything for yourself, Joe?
Well, because you mentioned Coventry, that's really sort of hit me very hard. As soon as you mentioned Coventry, of course I think of Mickey Quinn, and I think, how many goals did he score?
Got a hat-trick at Highbury.
It was the North Bank, wasn't it, as well?
Yeah. And that's all I can think about. I mean, opening days and always seem to be disappointing. I'm always sort of looking forward to the end of the season at that point.
Well, I love opening day though, sorry, yeah. Kevin, back in again. But when the sun's shining, first day, I always think of Highbury, even that time we're beaten 4-2 by Norwich, and we went 2-0 in the first half. But I just love the opening day. It's normally sunny, you have the optimism for the season, you normally just feel brilliant. And yeah, I normally love it. But for some reason, I think perhaps because we're away from home for the first match, I haven't quite got that buzz yet.
Well, I think that's to do with getting older and also a general malaise in expectations. Many memories. I remember Wimbledon away in 1988, they'd just won the FA Cup. We went there with a new look defence with a young chap called Steve Bold in accompanying Tony Adams.
He had hair.
Indeed. We won 5-1. I remember Leeds in 98 away, was 1-1 draw. Petit,
Ian Wright goal there, wasn't it, I think.
Ian Wright goal. Petit played in central midfield after having played pre-season as a central defender. Some Arsenal fans were unhappy that we allowed them to equalise, and there was slate in the team as we left. But we went on to it was 97 that was, we went on to win the league that season. Even 2009, Everton away 6-1.
And was that almost, the Nilsson goal as well? Almost, the Nilsson screamer.
I believe that might have been the shaky head dance celebration at the end. I can't remember, but that performance to me indicated a team that would go on and win the title. And I think we made a fist of it, but in the end, the usual story. But my God, they were good that day. Just going back. I mean, there's lots and lots and lots, but what was the one I was thinking of now? The memory's gone. But in 86, I remember enjoying. We beat Man United 1-0 with a very, very, very late Charlie Nicholas goal. If the sun's shining and it's all fresh, the pitches are wonderful. It's normally a time of optimism. You know, there's always hope at the start of a season. You're all level. You've got every chance. And yet, this season, that isn't the feeling. And you've got to ask yourself, why? You know, that isn't right.
It's not just age, Kevin. Don't tell me that, please. I thought it was just a kind of malaise.
You're probably right. It is a malaise. It's not age. Even the youngsters are probably feeling it.
Because when the sun's out and you walk up Highbury Way... And
I'll tell you what, there's an argument for summer football. After being at the Emirates Cup and seeing all... I mean, half the crowd were female, and it was so hot that it was a joy to be there.
Did you get a semi, Ken? Sorry.
I refuse to answer that question.
Sorry, David, for bringing the podcast
that's
into
fine.
Disrepute.
Hey, I tell you
Steve
what.
Steve Ashton's in the hill, because someone's got to do it, surely.
It's the only nature of having an absolutely brilliant, brilliant cast, I suppose, is the best way of putting it.
You're very, very kind, Dave.
That's my story that I'm sticking to. I mean, so many questions I wanted to ask about anything, like any impressions of the season's Emirates Cup, the fact that we got booed off after drawing one each with New York Red Bulls, the fact there'll be a new policy this season of not announcing the attendance as matches. Is that true?
I think that's because of me, actually.
Alvin Gazidis has confirmed that is the case.
Really?
Did you give any reason why, Kev?
Because basically he accepts that it's not a reflection of the genuine attendance.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he's admitted that, but I mean, the technical reason is it is based upon ticket sales, which is the industry standard and what all clubs do. But he's accepted it's become such a joke, not his words, mine, but that they didn't announce the attendance of the Emirates Cup, and that will be policy this season. So you will not get that announcement after 78 minutes anymore.
Well, to unfortunately wrap up in traditional style after 30 minutes, the email address for any communications about the podcast is goonapodcast@gmail.com. And thanks once again to our sponsors, GoonaShirts.com. Before we depart, just a quick opportunity for our Gooner editor to plug the first issue of the season. Away you go, please, Mr. Witcher.
Indeed, issue number 216 went on sale at the very Emirates Cup I've just discussed, and it continues to be available for the home games against Udinese and Liverpool. It's a bit of a redesign on the fanzine, done by a very good design guru who often works with us and does our front and back covers, thanks to Darren Rackham. Also, I'm going to take this opportunity to express my apologies to Steve Harris, who edited the letters, now renamed Inbox. And because of the design changes, we didn't leave a space to credit him. So
he that's will. That's unprofessional. I love the issue as well. I thought it was really good and nicely designed.
There are holes you haven't even seen.
Got
my friend.
Off that now, that new issue. Don't buy it out there.
Made a deliberate attempt to include some optimistic stroke pro Arsene Wenger articles in the name of balance. And if anyone wants to write anything for the Gooner, which is looking up, looking positive, more than welcome. We love that stuff, all right? Just because I don't happen to agree with it doesn't mean I'm not going to print it. So I'm encouraging anyone who doesn't like the tone of the editor to give me some contrast. But basically, it's still £2. It's full colour throughout now, and it's on sale the next two home matches.
Is it really fair to say, Kev, you're now about as popular as that, like Piers Morgan during his tenure at the Daily Mirror towards the end?
I have people who support me.
I am joking, listeners, because I was looking at the survey results, which are also in the issue, Kev, aren't they?
Indeed.
And they're very fascinating. And I must say, your editorial does come very high in the top articles, so I am but course, but I'm jesting.
Thank
they
you.
All love you, really.
Thank
you. Should be idiots that listen online. I can't say that because they probably download this podcast. Sorry about that.
Thank you again, Kevin. Thank you, Mr. Ollington. We'll be back very soon if all goes to plan, as the intention is to record some more podcast early next week with another specially convened panel of journalists who can hopefully give us something of an inside track on events. However, for now, with my thanks to the panel, it's time to say farewell. This is your host, David Udo, and thank you for listening.
La-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-dee, all good friends and jolly good company. Well, hey!